Environmental groups outlined their goals in a 50-page report titled Alaska in the 21st Century. The report says though the decade-old Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, or ANILCA, protects vast areas of the state, more needs protection. National Wildlife Federation President Jay Hare says with the advent of the Persian Gulf War, the immediate challenge is preventing oil exploration and development on the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
Opportunistic oil giants have made it a habit of using the backdrop of conflict in the Middle East to lower the nation's fear threshold. If left vulnerable to the desires of big oil, Alaska's at risk in terms of air, land, and water pollution, and a valuable resource like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge could be lost to us and to future generations.
Hare says U.S. demand for oil is like drug dependence. He says the solution is less reliance on foreign and domestic oil, coupled with effective conservation programs and alternative energy sources. But Hare and colleagues in groups such as the Wilderness Society and the Sierra Club doubt whether those will be key elements in the soon-to-be-released National Energy Strategy. Beyond Anwar, environmentalists are calling for several new wildlife refuges, expansion of current parks and refuges, and up to 100 million new acres designated as wilderness. They also want to see tighter administration of ANILCA and effective regulation of pollution and other environmental degradation. And finally, environmentalists would like to see the U.S. pursue a series of environmental protection treaties with the Soviet Union, Canada, and the other Arctic circumpolar countries, says Audubon Society President Peter Burley.
We make a mistake if we continue to think only of that region up there, but to recognize that it is part of a much broader ecological system which we have the opportunity to protect through treaties.
National Wildlife Federation President Jay Hare says now is a critical time for Alaska issues, both in Washington and Juneau.
Quite frankly, we're a little concerned about some of the messages we hear coming out of Governor Hickel's proposals, whether it's a railroad to Nome or a water pipe to Southern California to take fresh water down to that part of the nation. But most of the action on Alaska, because of the heavy dominance of federal lands, will be convened and conducted in this town. So it's a real watershed. It's a real important time. What we do in this Congress and the next Congress will determine what will be the ultimate eventual disposition of all Alaskan public lands.
On another matter, environmentalists are watching to see what happens in negotiations between Exxon, Alaska, and the federal government to settle damage claims from the 1989 Exxon Valdez oil spill. The Sierra Club's Mike Matz, chairman of the Alaska Coalition, says environmentalists are not averse to settling out of court. But he says Exxon must not be let off the hook.
For instance, early on when the Justice Department was considering some sort of out-of-court settlement, it appeared as though Exxon was going to be let off the hook and additionally would have had too much discretion over the settlement itself and what the money would have been used for. That's not appropriate. I mean, Exxon shouldn't be in the position of deciding how to use the settlement.
Matt says conservation groups are looking for a coherent plan that will protect Prince William Sound. For Alaska Public Radio, this is Joel Southern in Washington, D.C.
SASTE told members that a lot of problems with apparent cuts will be taken care of if the legislature approves the creation of the Alaska Investment Fund the governor wants. For example, the school construction debt.
The budget that we propose shows that $108 million would be paid out of that. However, if the Alaska Investment Fund is in effect, then we'll be able to fund the state's entire share of the school debt, which is about $123 million. So there's about $15 million of the reduction that's being touted in the school budget that would be covered by funding from the Alaska Investment Fund.
And maintenance that can't be put off any longer on existing facilities will also be covered in the $150 million capital budget.
Much of that deferred maintenance is maintenance that would have had to been included in the normal maintenance of some of the departments and some of the communities' maintenance budget too. So it kind of deflects some of the difficulties with the revenue sharing to the communities.
But Senate Finance Committee Co-Chairman Jay Kurtula calls the linkage of debt service and maintenance with the investment fund a carrot and stick that doesn't consider the Senate's budget responsibility.
And the transference of that responsibility under any guise to non-elected functionaries that vary with each administration and radically depart from any norm from time to time gives me a lot of problems.
Kurtula called this first hearing a love-in with the OMB, but he promised more spirited debate as details are explored. In Juneau, I'm Dave Donaldson.
Last fall's disappearance of a teenager shocked the community. When a second woman narrowly escaped an abduction, the mood got worse. Sales of whistles and personal sirens jumped, security patrols increased, and by early January, several self-defense classes were being held around town. Dale Florian, security director at UAF and instructor of a nine-hour program called Hurt and Run, says much of his class time is spent teaching women that with just a little help, they can learn to protect themselves.
I want to show them small things that do work that anybody can do. Doesn't take strength, doesn't take physical agility, doesn't take a lot of things. It just takes the knowledge. They've been shortchanged, and nobody's ever showed this stuff to them before.
The stuff ranges from simple pinches to throat strikes, but all involve pain, something Florian says presents a constant challenge for the students.
The first and uppermost thing is I find it very, very difficult for women to accept the fact that they have to hurt somebody else.
At a recent class, Florian taught 15 women aged 17 to 50 plus a repertoire of techniques to be used in different situations, all involved inflicting pain, some with the help of a plastic cigar-shaped tool called a Cubaton.
There are some things that are just very simply done. The handshake. This is just simply to tell you what it can do. It's a parlor game. Probably you may never need it. Somebody wants to grab your hand again. Some men get into this macho image, won't let go, and they won't let go. They hold on. You simply put this in the web and draw down. I can do all kinds of things with her. As soon as I know I've got her attention with this, I let go.
Florian's techniques focus on surprising an attacker with sharp pain, the hurt, which allows victims enough time to break the hold and escape, the run.
Let me choke. Wait a minute. You choke me. Okay, grab her this hand. Yeah. Press the heel against her.
Right, and you want to get up a little bit higher right in here. Okay?
In there. Is that it?
But keep this steady and don't move this and scoop it.
Ooh.
Like this. Okay?
Okay, right in there. Ooh. Okay.
How are we doing?
The class is rigorous. In 9 hours, the students have to unlearn much of what they believe. They're told that the popular kick him in the groin is difficult to accomplish. Instead, Florian recommends targets like the Adam's apple, knees, or eyes. Generally, the women appreciate the program. After accepting that they must hurt another person, most of their reservations come from having to learn so much in so little time. Participant Robin Robinson.
In one respect, I'm a little more frightened than before, but I think that'll calm down as I've had a chance to think it all through. In some respects, as far as an idea of a guy at a party or somebody bothering me, I think I've gained some techniques I can use and feel confident that they'll work.
The students say they are now more aware of their surroundings, that they have begun sizing up the potential dangers of everyday situations like just leaving work. They call it paranoia, but Florian calls it awareness. Whatever the definition, a woman named Jordan says the class helped her feel more secure now that she knows she can defend herself.
I get tired of feeling nervous. And I figured that courses like this can help me to spend less time being nervous or being unsure or insecure or all those negative kinds of feelings.
Fifth graders in Dean Jaquish's class at Wrangell's Evergreen Elementary School haven't heard from their soldier pen pals in Saudi Arabia since the fighting with Iraq began. The kids started writing when the soldiers were involved in Desert Shield, the build-up of forces that has since evolved into Desert Storm. About 16 soldiers replied. Some of them struck up regular correspondence with the kids. But Jaquish says the letter-writing program has now been put on hold.
We try not to dwell on it quite as much. And I've advised the kids that it's unlikely that they'll get letters for a while. These soldiers definitely have some different priorities all of a sudden.
Jaquish says a couple of kids have written to their soldiers since the fighting started, saying they're following the news and hoping that they'll return home safely.
I've had one student write to a soldier's home address. He included his home address in his initial letter and said that you could write to my family if you want. And so in the last day, she's drafted a letter to the soldier's family and expressing her hope for the soldier to return safely, and also sharing some of the things that she's written to him and explained how many letters she's written and how many packages she sent to him.
The kids had been sending packages containing everything from good luck teddy bears to canned seafood for the soldiers, but have discontinued sending parcels since media reports indicated that the troops had been inundated with mail and there was difficulty distributing it all. Jaquish says the war has gone from a daily topic of discussion in class to something that's only dealt with as questions arise.
Most of the experts on the television are telling us that that's about the best way to handle the situation right now is just not dwell on it for the kids, and otherwise it becomes too much of a concern for them.
But he says the war is still very much on everyone's mind.
It probably creeps into our day, you know, at least probably about once a day. Sometimes the day goes by with not too much is mentioned about it. I think kids are like anybody else. Sometimes it's kind of nice just to tune out bad news for a while.
Teacher Dean Jaquish. In Wrangell, I'm Rhonda Litchwag.
Yeah. This rally is in support of our flag and in support of our country, and as well as our countrymen that are serving in Saudi Arabia. We are neither saying we are for nor against. We are just trying to bring the support that should be at home out into the open.
3, 2, 1. Governor Hickel hopes to convince the legislature to invest some $600 million the state expects to see from higher oil prices. Jim Hasselberger manages the governor's Fairbanks office. He explained the investment plan to chamber members, pointing out its primary goal is to pay off the state's general and school debt. After that, the funds will be used to develop regional projects. Hasselberger thinks Fairbanks will like the plan because it should eventually mean lower tax bills.
With the money going into the Alaska Investment Fund and the state guaranteeing the state bonded indebtedness and school bond indebtedness, it's going to reduce the operating budget 10%. The state operating budget 10%, and it's also going to reduce, for example, the Fairbanks North Star Borough's budget, because instead of the borough paying the school bonded indebtedness, the state is guaranteeing the payment or is making the payment. So it would really result in possibly some lowering of income or real estate taxes in local communities.
The Alaska Investment Fund would be run much like the Permanent Fund, with the Board of Trustees overseeing it and the legislature appropriating the money for it. Governor Hickel plans to try to sell the idea directly to the people. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton.
I pledge allegiance to the flag.
It started as a tribute to the flag, but the people involved in the Middle East war were really the center of attention. Fairbanks Mayor Wayne Nelson told the group that there can be no comparison between this war and the one in Vietnam.
In trying to remember, I do not recall at any time a community getting together as we are here today to show support for the troops during that period. But even if some of you can remember a time when that happened, I'll bet almost no one can remember a time when something like that was organized for a community by university students.
The rally was organized by a group of UAS students who wanted to counter anti-war demonstrations with one of their own. Retired Army Colonel Wally Cox drew the most applause and a standing ovation, as he criticized Saddam Hussein for causing the war and blamed the major media and what he calls professional war protesters for helping Hussein think he can win the propaganda war against the U.S.
Major networks continue to, in the tradition of sensationalism and dramatization. It's all right to have a differing view, not to support the war, but let me tell you something. Those who do should find the right channel to do it. If there are to be demonstrations, if there are to be gatherings, speaking out, parades, then this is the kind of gathering that should occur so that our soldiers and our leaders know that we are united solidly behind them, not rending the fabric of our society by open dissent and giving aid and comfort to the enemy.
Cox says those against the war should channel their dissent in positive, productive directions.
Mama just arrived at Desert Shield.
With a small flag on his guitar, local musician Earl Hughes sang his song about Desert Shield and moved on to America the Beautiful and the Star-Spangled Banner. The crowd sang along, some with tears in their eyes and others waving flags. Many of them left feeling good.
I really enjoyed it. I think we need more things like this. I just am supportive support groups like this and activities like this. I think it's great. I think it's fantastic. I think that's what we need.
My husband served in World War II and in Korea, and I'm thrilled to see this happen. I think this is wonderful. It's long overdue, this kind of support for our country, our nation, and what we stand for, what we believe in.
It was great. It was really inspiring. Real inspiring. I almost cried.
And if I die here in this holy land, with fields of oil all covered with sand, I was proud to be a part to defend that line at Operation Desert Shield.
For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. Women who drink while pregnant run the risk of having a child with fetal alcohol syndrome. Those children may be born retarded, show signs of hyperactivity, and have a short attention span. Others may be born with fetal alcohol effect, which is less severe but still creates special learning problems. In either case, it's too late for the message prevention programs carry, and educators are finding a whole new challenge when FAS kids reach school age. UAF psychology professor Judy Kleinfeld has put together a two-day conference to focus attention on those educational challenges. It's a problem Kleinfeld says she knew many schools and teachers were facing.
I did a review of the research literature, and I found zero articles on how teachers can work effectively with children with alcohol-related birth defects. The conference is bringing together people from all over the country who have worked with the children and who know how to do it. They haven't written anything, but they know how. And what we're trying to do is to get them together, let them bounce ideas off each other, and help teachers and parents within Alaska learn more about how they can develop each child as much as possible.
Kleinfeld says discovering how to work with these kids and develop their strengths is happening, but many are doing it in isolation. So she's lined up participants from Canada, like a woman who developed an alternative school for children suffering from FAS, and another who can tell parents of FAS kids how to work with the school system. A panel of teachers will also talk about using the right strategies for kids at the right ages. And Barbara Morse, the director of a fetal alcohol education program at Boston University School of Medicine, will also share her theories.
She thinks that one of the main damage that's done by alcohol abuse in early pregnancy is that it's hurting the brain's ability to process information. And the child can't get it when it's presented, especially verbally. So if you put up the pictures, the child can get it. He's got another channel to do it and another modality, the visual, to get the information in. So we're hoping that bringing together some practitioners and some university people, we're going to be able to figure out what's gone wrong educationally and what, in a practical sense, can we do about it.
Kleinfeld says this is the first international conference on fetal alcohol syndrome focusing on education. It seems the logical next step now that the public knows more about FAS and how to prevent it.
We know that programs which work with pregnant mothers who abuse alcohol as late as the second trimester can tremendously reduce the incidence of fetal alcohol syndrome. And we know that community education programs which get information out have enormous effects, with about 80% of the women in reducing the amount of alcohol consumed. So we know what it is, and we are developing information on how to prevent it. But before now, no one has taken a systematic look on how we educate the children that slip through the cracks of the prevention programs and are coming into the schools.
The conference takes place on Friday and Saturday. Saturday's sessions at UAF's Wood Center are open to the public at no charge. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. Testimony tonight and Thursday evening should be fairly one-sided. Critics of the reading series have more than 6 hours to make their case. Even so, attorney Daniel Saluri says that isn't enough time for the 50 appellants, 26 expert witnesses, and 200 or so others who would like to speak out against the books. The main witness tonight will be Don Marquis, a former witch now considered an occult specialist, who says the books espouse blatant occultism. He's planning to write a book about it. Marquis was flown here by the Citizens for Quality Education. Attorney Saluri says the costs of airfare were donated by a member. Whether or not Marquis will be compensated for his testimony hasn't been decided yet by the group. Marquis claims to have spent more than 2,000 hours studying the books. During his visit this week, he's making appearances around town to illustrate the occultism he sees in the books. He spoke to a group at the Carlson Center last night. Marquis says between 75 and 90% of the book's stories feature themes of violence, occultism, or deaths and killings, points which the publisher's owner, Harcourt, Brace, and Janovich, flatly deny. Vice President for Corporate Communications, Anson Franklin, says those claims are not supported by the facts.
It's a case where a critic will go into the series looking for an example to prove a point and will come up with some obscure passage or artwork and subject it to his or her own interpretation. It is certainly not an interpretation that a majority of people would apply to the writings. This is serious literature that was compiled to educate children, to interest them in literature. We do not put specific tests or messages in this literature. We just try to pick things that will help the children. The selections are the result of a lengthy and complex process in which we use educational consultants and experts in the field and talk to teachers and even in some cases test some of them on children. It's good literature.
Franklin says opponents are using rumors and half-truths and taking articles out of context to attack the books. He says fewer than 10% of the school districts which use Holt Impressions have complained about the series, and the majority of those districts have agreed to keep the books. With some 400 districts nationwide using Holt Impressions, Franklin doesn't see the claims of occultism as a major challenge.
What concerns us are two things. One is that a lot of parents who are genuinely concerned about the welfare of their children are receiving information that distorts what these books are trying to do, and we're concerned that they're not getting a full and fair explanation of the series. What bothers us, secondly, is that we think that a small percentage of the population is trying to impose its views on a much larger population who would benefit from these books. We're great believers in the school system and the book selection process in these communities. We think they're very thorough and very fair, and we would hate to see that subverted.
It isn't just satanic or negative themes parents who don't like the books oppose. They also plan to challenge how the books were piloted by the school district, how they were purchased, and vocational aspects of the books. The hearings begin at 7 o'clock tonight at Ryan Middle School. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. Book supporters wore bright yellow tags that say, "Keep the books." Opponents wore small white buttons that say nothing, since nothing is what they think the books are worth. A man claiming to be an occult specialist based on his years as a witch spent more than 2 hours trying to convince the school board that the books teach the religion of witchcraft, and since religious teaching isn't allowed in public schools, the books shouldn't be either. Some parents also had time to testify last night. What they consider an emphasis on violence in the Impression series is what they find so objectionable. Opponents say they have a petition that they'll present with nearly 2,000 names of people who agree with their cause. Testimony about the Impressions textbooks continues tonight and Friday. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Book supporters wore bright yellow tags that say, "Keep the books." Opponents wore small white buttons that say nothing, since nothing is what they think the books are worth. A man claiming to be an occult specialist based on his years as a witch spent more than 2 hours trying to convince the school board that the books teach the religion of witchcraft. And since religious teaching isn't allowed in public schools, the books shouldn't be either. Some parents also had time to testify against the books last night. Retired teacher and mother of six, Sharon Boko, says she's not an extremist, but an average person, and she doesn't like these books.
I'm not opposed to reality. Our kids have been getting a large dose of it every night on TV, watching the news of our country at war with Iraq. I'm not opposed to fantasy or make-believe, but I am opposed to negative, violent material, be it real life or fantasy. Can our first graders afford to spend 6 years of reading this kind of material?
Sharon and Bob Boko also expressed disappointment with the way the appeals are being handled, saying what's needed is to sit down and talk and not some formal hearing process. Book opponents say they have a petition that they'll present with nearly 2,000 names of people who agree with their cause. Testimony continues tonight and Friday at Ryan Middle School. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. The 50 or so people who appealed the district decision to keep using the Holt Impressions textbooks have been allotted 9 minutes each during the hearing process. They gave up much of that time last night to Doc Marquis, a man who claims to have been a witch for 20 years and says the books are filled with occult references. Marquis says that Impressions teaches the religion of witchcraft, and since religion cannot be taught in public schools, the books should go. School board members listened as Marquis listed story after objectionable story. He also spent a lot of time pointing out subliminal messages he sees in Impressions illustrations, particularly in a colorful picture with a story called Lavender's Blue. Marquis took it apart and turned it upside down to show a skull, goat's head, and demonic faces in the work, prompting board president Andy Warwick to ask what was wrong with that.
On the picture up there, I see a cat with a goatee, and if I turn it over, I see a cleverly drawn bear, and I suspect kids will see different things in it. And I guess my question is, what's the harm in that? I think it's rather neatly drawn, and it's clever. And
the harm is somebody has purposely put subliminal pictures on that. That's the harm.
Well, what's the harm in seeing a cat and a bear, or if it's a goat, a goat, or a monkey, or anything?
The point is, when you said a goat, we all know that that goat, especially since it has the horns, you can easily see that with any other satanic picture that is the symbol of satanic worship.
Board members asked Marquis a lot of questions about his knowledge and background, and they asked many specific questions about why he finds certain materials objectionable. The board also heard from some parents last night. Most objected to what they see as too much violence in the textbooks. By far the most emotional was LaVon Guffey. The mother of 5 young children, Guffey says kids need to learn the difference between bad and good, but these books don't help teach that. She broke down more than once while reading her testimony. She says the realities of life are bad enough, and kids will face them soon enough.
Please let the children be children. Don't confront them with adult decisions when they're still babies. Don't deprive them of their childhood.
Guffey says young children can't go to R-rated movies, so they should get R-rated books out of the schools. The hearings also featured some expert witnesses. One was a curriculum consultant who testified over the phone from California, a professor at Azusa Pacific University, and Croissant listed numerous objections to the books, including what she called repeated exposure to undesirable things. Another who testified, local pastor David Boyd, says the book's overall teaching is in opposition to Christianity. He referenced specific stories and books several times and quoted scripture to show what was wrong with them.
You know, Christianity is built on truth. The Bible is a book of truth. In the 5th grade student book, Knock at the Door, page 80, there's a story about Maui, the legendary god of the island of Maui in Hawaii. In quote, The book says, legends and myths explain why things are as they are. That's simply a lie. That is not the truth. Myths and legends are fanciful stories that tell how someone imagined things are. Myths and legends are very interesting stories. I read lots of them as I grew up, but I knew they were myths and legends. Nobody ever told me this. See, this simply is not the truth. But the book is telling the students that. Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. John 14:6.
The board quit for the evening while Boyd was wrapping up his speech, which was also submitted to board members in writing. The first night of hearings is finished, but there's still a long way to go. More objections to the books will be aired tonight, followed by the superintendent's explanation of why he thinks the book should stay. Testimony from the rest of the public doesn't start until Friday night, and some 140 people have already signed up for that. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. Attorney for the group, Daniel Saluri, started off last night's meeting complaining and asking that opponents of the reading series get more time tonight to present their testimony. Some of them aren't happy that expert testimony took precedence over their own. Appellants were given a block of more than 6 hours over Wednesday and Thursday nights. Still, about 30 haven't had time to speak. Saluri says they should get that time, since they appealed the decision to keep the books in the first place.
We have people out here who were the public, who walked in off of the street, who signed to make their public comments 6 months ago, who have met deadlines over that six-month period through a committee review process and an appeal process, who you will be turning away and saying, you're gagged, you cannot speak, because we're going to open it up to public comment for a full day on Friday for the Johnny-come-lately who walked in here and signed a sheet of paper.
But the board's schedule for the meeting is already established, and instead of starting off the meeting discussing problems, Board President Andy Warwick suggested opponents get started with the rest of their testimony.
We're giving you somewhere in the vicinity of 7 hours of our time. We're giving this issue approximately 12 to 15 hours these three nights. We've given this issue countless hours in the past 2 months. You're testing my patience.
In fact, the appellants got a little more time last night. The superintendent was to have an hour to defend his decision to retain impressions. But since he only plans to speak for a few minutes, opponents were allowed to continue their case until 11 o'clock. But then when Attorney Saluri started to complain about the time limit again, Warwick called it quits for the night without hearing from the superintendent. Book opponents stuck around for a while to discuss whether or not they'll try for more time tonight. 15 people did testify during the second night of hearings. The first five were ministers who don't like what they see the Impression series teaching children. A similar complaint came from Dr. Enlo Walker, who oversees medical care at the Fairbanks Youth Facility. Walker says many of the kids he sees there come from bad environments, and he's read some of the stories they've written.
And a lot of the stories that they write are very similar to the stories that are in this series of books that we're teaching to our children. And these are not the result of a sound mind. These are stories that are written by kids that have severe emotional problems in a lot of cases.
Others criticize the district's use of the whole language approach to learning, using activities and literature to develop language and reading skills. Pamela Bickford and Joy Cook say it doesn't teach the skills kids need to learn to read. Bickford also says district procedures weren't followed when Holt Impressions was piloted, since no control groups were used, nor were parents surveyed. And a first grade teacher also asked the school board to reconsider the decision to keep the books in schools. Annie Doherty cited examples of how children's imagination and fascination can guide their futures. But she says Impressions is not intellectually stimulating and doesn't positively challenge the students.
Thomas Edison developed his critical thinking skills by reading books like Gibbon's The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by the age of 12. If he were taught to read and think using the Impression series, we'd still be sitting in the dark.
I admit that there are many delightful stories and wonderful illustrations in the Impression series, but there are copious distasteful selections with offensive illustrations.
Doherty says she doesn't use the Impression series and suggested the district expand use of the reading series she does use, trade books. A few other parents also had time to testify against the books last night. Tonight's hearing is scheduled to begin with public comment at 7 o'clock. More than 100 people are signed up. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 15 people had time to testify, ministers, parents, and a couple of teachers. They asked the school board to get a refund on Holt Impressions and choose less offensive books for the language arts curriculum. First grade teacher Annie Doherty says she piloted the curriculum 2 years ago, although not Holt Impressions, but she says questions about those books did come up during the piloting process, and teachers were told they would get a different version of Impressions, and she trusted they would, so she didn't take her concern to the school board before. But she says most teachers wanted to pilot the series for another year.
That request was denied. Many teachers who had examined or piloted the Holt series stated their concerns with the questionable content of the series, specifically the preponderance of the occult, its effects on children, and its acceptance in our community. These concerns fell on deaf ears. You may wonder where the other teachers are who share my belief. There are many of them in our district. They feel that their professional opinions will once again fall on deaf ears.
Doherty suggested that instead of using Impressions, the board expand the district's use of a different reading series, trade books. The hearings ended with a little bit of chaos last night. Book opponents want more time to make their case and believe opponents who haven't had time to testify yet should get precedence over the public comment scheduled for tonight. The opponents were given a little more time than scheduled last night because the superintendent plans to be fairly brief when he's called to defend his decision to keep the books. That was supposed to happen last night, but the meeting was quickly adjourned when book opponents started to complain again about time limits. Board President Andy Warwick says tonight, we'll see what happens. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. Friday night's hearing was set aside for public comment. It featured perhaps the largest and best-behaved crowd, who laughed at times but never applauded or booed any of the speakers. The testimony moved along very quickly since school board members asked no questions. They just listened as one by one critics and supporters of the reading series offered their opinions. And the majority support the district's decision to continue using Holt Impressions. While critics had two nights to make their case, Friday night saw many speakers singing the praises of the books. Some teachers offered testimonials. Elementary school reading specialist Chris Wilson told the school board what happened when two of her fifth grade classes read one of the books in question about a girl who starves herself to death when her parents won't buy her a pony.
When questioned on the character of Abigail, the children said she was selfish, stubborn, and spoiled. When asked about the author, the children recognized him as a humorist, and they laughed at the ridiculous behavior of the girl. When asked if this poem was to be considered fiction or nonfiction, they resoundingly responded, "Fiction, Mrs. Wilson."
Another book supporter, Barbara Short, says she surveyed each school to find out how big an issue these books really are. Her figures show that controversy is non-existent at some schools. She says 104 families have told principals some material is objectionable, representing 2% of the families with elementary school kids.
This information tells us that 98% of the parent population in our schools have not requested restrictions. Why not? Well, I would suggest that they are contented working, living, reading, writing, and parenting. I believe that most of the people you have not heard from are good parents, just as I believe are the people on both sides of this issue. And if they felt these books were dangerous to their own children, they would also be here.
Parents and teachers defended the whole language approach to education and the quality writers that the Impression series features. Instead of problems, many teachers say they've witnessed children learning to enjoy reading. Some say the debate isn't about reading and the fate of Impressions. but about censorship and ideology, and a few parents who don't just want the right to determine what their own children read, but want to limit choices for everyone's kids. Sue Yerian says that parents cannot monitor everything their children will see, read, and hear, and in response to fears that impressions may lead children into the occult, Steve Mitchell pointed out that reading something doesn't mean you'll become something.
My daughter has been reading Greek myths over the last month. I feel very confident that she is able to distinguish between fantasy and reality, and I don't think that she's going to adopt the Greek schema as her belief system simply because she's read those books.
Opponents say the books are scary and frighten children. Supporters say you can't ban everything that kids consider frightening, and pointed out that kids have been having nightmares for years. While parents on both sides agree that it's their job to teach their children morals and values, book opponents say impressions goes against what they teach. For some, it's an issue of teachers' rights versus parental rights. But parent Karen Takau says these books don't undermine her parental authority.
I don't want them replaced by something more suitable because I think these are great books. Not on the whole or overall, but completely. I see nothing wrong with anything in them. I'm not stupid or blind or an uncaring parent. I simply have faith in my children, their intelligence, and my parenting skills. There's nothing here that threatens them or me.
Of the 82 people who testified under public comment Friday, 48 of them supported the decision to continue using Holt Impressions. 34 were opposed to it, for many of the same reasons mentioned the previous two evenings. Many agree that there are good stories in Impressions, but there are too many of what they consider to be scary stories for children at an impressionable age. And they're also concerned that the books teach witchcraft and promote violence. Brock Bean has a daughter in first grade.
And I don't want her at all to be exposed to this type of stuff. I've seen the violence in it. I've seen the references to witchcraft. And you guys have too. And if you're saying to yourself right now, well, I don't believe that. Well then, I believe that you're not opening your hearts to it. Or your eyes.
After the public comment, the school board agreed to stay another hour to hear from those appealing the superintendent's decision to continue using Holt Impressions. 17 took advantage of their 3 minutes at the microphone to finish public criticism of the books. Former teacher Ruth Ewig has been one of the leaders in the fight against them.
Now, what I hear from teachers is that the teachers ought to be allowed to do what they want with their students, but their students are our children. Somehow there's got to be a partnership. I'm concerned that they want to do what they want with our children and we're not included. Is the state in control of our children or are we as parents in control of our children?
Teachers on both sides of the issue have also been put on the spot during this debate. One said Thursday night that teachers who don't like Impressions have been afraid to speak out. But Friday night, Dixon Jones testified that teachers who support the books feel threatened by book opponents. Other speakers noted that the issue has divided the community. Friday night's final speaker was one who has been very outspoken throughout the controversy, Paige C. Seemingly worn out after a long fight against the books, C. noted the divisiveness isn't accomplishing anything.
This is ridiculous. It's not about who's a Christian or not. It's not about, you know, it's not about any of that. It's about the kids, and I hope you guys can see past some of the insults and personal comments that have been made and really keep them first in your minds when you make this decision.
More than 50 people who signed up to testify Friday night didn't get the chance before time ran out. They can submit their testimony in writing today. That includes the superintendent, who never got to testify, and will submit his defense to the school board in writing. The board is expected to decide next week whether to uphold his decision or not. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. One woman who supports continued use of Holt Impressions in the classroom says her informal survey shows only 2% of the elementary school families have problems with the books. She says that shows quiet but overwhelming support for the school district. 82 people testified about the books Friday night. 48 like them, 34 don't. Elementary school teacher Janice Riley says she's used the series for 4 years.
I have not personally received a single complaint or concern about any materials that I have selected for use with the children in my care. I have, on the other hand, been witness to the joy and excitement experienced by the child whose exposure to literature promotes a lifelong interest in reading.
Many parents say the school district is looking out for the children's best interest, and parents should trust the teachers and the kids. Parent and furnace repairman Bruce Delbridge has 4 children in the public schools.
If you think that Satan is behind the impression series, don't take the impression series and throw it out any more than if you think your nozzle is clogged in your furnace, that you take your furnace out and throw it out in the front yard at 40 below.
In fact, much of the testimony Friday offered praise for the school district. Parents on both sides of the issue say they think the schools are doing a good job. But Pat Walker doesn't think Holt Impressions does.
I find this series to contain stories, poems, and suggested classroom activities that contain excessive references to the occult, provoke unnecessary fear, provide graphic descriptions of violence to main characters, both physical and emotional, and a lack of respect for basic human life. Because I believe this does in no way mean that I want you to return to the dark ages of education and resurrect Dick and Jane. I want my children to have the best and most stimulating reading material that you can find.
Anyone who still wants to comment on the controversy over Holt Impressions can deliver testimony to the school district today. The school board is expected to decide next week what the fate of Holt Impressions will be. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. 3, 2, 1. The school board made it clear that it wants Holt Impressions to stay, but 2 school board members did say they also feel the books are too violent. So Gene Redden and Mike Kramer wanted to clearly establish available classroom alternatives for children whose parents object to the books. Gene Redden says the issues aren't witchcraft and Satanism, the book selection process, or censorship and religion. He believes academic freedom is partly an issue, but Redden says the real issues are what's best for the kids and the role of parents. He says his provision would allow parents to have a choice.
No matter how I may feel about the Holt Impressions series, whether I approve of them or disapprove of them, the real issue is that parents who disapprove of them ought to be given a choice to not have their kids use them. Parents who approve of them ought to also be given that choice of using it if that's their desire. And I think that making sure that that choice is provided to parents has become the issue in my mind.
The only other board member who agreed with Redden was Mike Kramer. The rest of the board says district policy already gives parents options. They can talk to their child's principal and teacher and let them know what material is objectionable. The teacher can either skip those stories or have the child read something else. Jerry McBeth says he's all for parental choice, but he's not sure creating alternative classrooms in each school is feasible, or if 2 reading series is an effective way to handle the controversy.
If we want to make an accommodation, then the accommodation has to be one that will work, will not be a knee-jerk response, that we'll be able to think through carefully and make sure that we are accommodating parents well, that we're taking their objections and the nature of their objections fully and completely into account. And we can't do this, it seems to me, under the gun.
The board let the superintendent's decision stand without tacking on any extra provisions, which left at least one parent who doesn't like the books unhappy. Lisa Seitz left the meeting disappointed, saying parents opposed to the books didn't get much of an answer. Seitz says she doesn't think alternative classrooms are the answer, but would have been happy with that since she didn't think the board would do what she would have liked it to do, get rid of the series. She saw the decision as a victory for the group supporting the books, Citizens for Academic Freedom.
If I would have come out of here tonight with the decision to reject the series, I would have felt a victory, but it would have been for kids, not for me. Whereas they come out with a victory for academic freedom, not for the kids, you know, really. I mean, because the kids can't make their own choice. They just can't. So I'm disappointed it came down to a cause instead of the kids. I feel like it really did.
Parents against Impressions are still concerned that their children will be exposed to the series, even if they opt out of them. And some are concerned that their child is being singled out in the classroom when excluded from stories in the books. But one of the chief supporters of retaining Holt Impressions, Nikki Eisman, says she thinks teachers are going out of their way to comply with parents' wishes.
Because I think that if a teacher sees a parent complaint as valid, that they are more likely than not to accommodate them, particularly in this climate that we've been in the last 5 months. The teachers, I think many teachers have bent over backwards to accommodate. I know that I have, as a librarian, have found that I've self-censored in response to this whole issue. I'm not proud of that, but I know that I have.
With the decision to keep Holt Impressions, School Superintendent Rick Cross meets with elementary school principals Monday to go over procedures and make sure that parents still concerned about the series have been accommodated. Meanwhile, individual parents who appealed the decision to keep the books aren't sure what action they'll take next, if any. But the Citizens for Quality Education, which formed as a result of the controversy, says they aren't going away. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. Two school board members, Mike Kramer and Jean Redden, voiced concerns about the violence in the books. Both tried to ensure that alternative choices would be available in all the schools for parents who don't want their children reading from Holt Impressions. But when the rest of the board wouldn't go along with those stipulations, Mike Kramer says he wouldn't have any choice but to vote to get rid of Impressions.
I was hoping for a compromise. I was hoping to accommodate those who object and also satisfy those who agree with the books and want them to stay in the system. But I don't see witchcraft. I don't see Satanism, although I know that a lot of people do. What I see, though, is graphic violence that I'm not comfortable with, and I'm not comfortable with the children being exposed to that and some of the depressive themes.
Board member Walt Schlofeld says he understands the other parents' concerns, but he had his sixth-grade daughter read the books, and all her comments were positive. Schlofeld feels parents already have an option if they don't want their children to read Holt Impressions.
Perhaps we can find other ways of providing alternatives. However, I think it would be wrong for us to throw the books out.
The board voted 5-2 to keep the books, affirming the superintendent's decision to keep them in the schools. Parents who don't like Holt Impressions still have concerns that their children are exposed to the books even after they've pointed out objectionable stories. Superintendent Rick Cross says he'll meet with principals next Monday to go over procedures when parents raise those concerns and continue to try to accommodate them. And Cross says he hopes they can be accommodated.
I don't want them to feel that they have to pull their children out of our school district. And I think there are long-term things that need to happen in the school district that allow for more flexibility in schools that would be able to resolve this. I would hope that if this kind of issue wouldn't be a possibility 5 years from now.
The school board spent part of its meeting talking about school choice. The State Department of Education has asked the district to pilot a school choice program where parents could send their child to any district school. The administration is looking at how to arrange busing for children to get to any of those schools, and the district hopes to survey parents to determine community interest in open enrollment. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Three, two, one. The FDA is asking the state for some $6.7 million. The development group wants the money to start a neighborhood housing program, renovate the Lathrop Building, restore the Lacey Street Theater, and build a parking garage downtown on the same block as the Savoy Bar. Earlier in the week, the Fairbanks City Council agreed to back some of the ideas, but the borough assembly didn't appear eager to do so. Assemblymember Paul Chismar noted that in the contest for capital money, the FDA needs aren't the highest priority.
I don't think I could really support this resolution either. Legislators commonly ask, would you like to see Denali Center funded, or would you like to have the Development Authority have a new parking garage? And I think I'd offer a new Denali Center.
FDA Executive Director Harry Hardung told the assembly the goal is to revitalize the downtown area. But Assemblymember Bonnie Williams wanted to know where he was a few months ago when the Assembly was working on its own capital funding requests emphasizing economic development.
Are you aware the borough went through a process back in October, November, developing a specific list of projects that would help economic development?
Yes, I'm aware that they went through
but the FDA didn't come forward with anything then.
The Assembly didn't seem very interested in approving the resolutions, but rather than go on the record against the ideas, they postponed action on them indefinitely. The Assembly also postponed action on some budget transfers that the administration wants to help cover the costs of pay raises. Administrative Director Rick Navin told the Assembly that departments have already absorbed a good portion of the pay raise costs, but budget adjustments are needed before the last few months of the fiscal year. Navin says the longer it takes to make the transfers, the more it will hurt. But the Assembly wasn't eager to act on that either, since there still is no union contract, and the 4% pay raise the mayor is paying has never been approved by the Assembly. The Assembly did approve a resolution outlining the borough's intent to transfer Old Main School to the city of Fairbanks. That won't happen until the school district offices move from that building to the Fifth Avenue Center, but the city wants to turn Old Main into a new police station eventually, and wants it on record that the borough does plan to turn over that land. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
Oh, beautiful for space.
Spurred by news coverage of anti-war demonstrations, this group decided to show support for the troops in its own way. Organized by some UAF students, the rally featured local musician Earl Hughes, along with civic, community, and religious leaders like Reverend Denver Copeland.
They need to see on the TV, instead of all the rallies going against it, they need to see the support that is given by people for them that are over there too. Thank you.
Fairbanks Mayor Wayne Nelson told the crowd, regardless of their feelings about war, they need to let the troops know they have support. About 200 people turned out for the event, singing, waving small flags, and shedding some tears. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. Dr. Commissar says the university system gets a little less money from the general fund now than it did 6 years ago. During that time, the administration has been restructured to save money, and other belt-tightening measures have been taken to keep up with inflation. But Commissar says some of those things can't go on for long. Eventually, the maintenance problems have to be taken care of, and library acquisitions can only be reduced so far. With a proposed state budget that cuts the university system's funding by nearly $12 million, Commissar says it could be another lean year.
The hope on my part, and certainly on the part of the Board of Regents of the university, was to look at 1992 as a year when there would be some progress in the service and offerings of the university, that we would make some inroads in the deferred maintenance problems that we face, particularly here at the Fairbanks campus, that we would begin to create some new programs or expand some very effective programs that have brought Native Alaskans to the university and are helping them succeed as students at the university, and that we would begin to make some greater investment in the extension services that the university offers around the state of Alaska. As the budget looks right now, most of those things will be impossible to accomplish. That the budget with its, the executive budget, with the cut in resources it proposes, will simply continue the university on a very difficult trajectory, and that is to continue to defer maintenance, to continue to inadequately supply its library, to continue to operate with old equipment, and to not really build toward the future that I think we all want.
Commissar says he hopes the system will be in better shape at the end of the budget process than it is at the beginning. The U of A system president says Governor Hickel is supportive of education. Commissar says he'd like to translate Hickel's understanding of the importance of education into cash flow. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. Governor Walter Hickel outlined his vision of Alaska last night. Tomorrow night, he'll tell us how he wants to pay for it. In his first State of the State message, Hickel brought up many campaign themes he considers the key to Alaska's independence. Governor Hickel unveiled few surprises in his 25-minute speech to the state legislature. He did ask that legislators consider a 75-day limit on their annual sessions and an 8-year limit on terms of office. But the rest of the speech featured familiar issues and pet projects of the governor. Hickel says Alaska has been to Disneyland since Prudhoe Bay started production, but it's time to get back to work and do more for ourselves.
Once we have found, cut, or caught a resource, we must break out of that third world mentality. We must stop shipping it somewhere else without value-added processing. We export our fish, and they are returned to the corner market. We at Japan as halibut steaks or fish sticks. Why should Tokyo or Seattle bank our bounty?
Hickel again stressed his desire to extend the Alaska Railroad to the Yukon, build a major port facility in Cook Inlet, and a natural gas line from the North Slope. He also wants to upgrade the marine highway system. But more than capital investments, Hickel did briefly touch on investing in people. He says the key to excellence in schools is competition, and emphasized parental choice and exploring the voucher system. And higher education also has a role to play.
Here in Alaska, our own universities should become the premier academic and research centers for Arctic sciences and for educating pioneers of a civilization in the North Country and how to make it work. A university here cannot exist with a wall around it. It must be tied to our culture, our social needs, and our economics.
Hickel also says he wants to solve problems he inherited when taking office, including restoring the Mental Health Land Trust Fund, maintaining control over state fisheries, and keeping our forests healthy. And perhaps the biggest problem he inherited, subsistence, he says will be his top priority.
I think we now have a challenge to untangle this mess. My belief is that we Alaskans can solve it together. But first, let's stop threatening each other, and let's celebrate all cultures, and not pretend that one heritage is more or less important than the other. The key is to focus on the real problem, the shortage of food or game, in a time of reduced fish and game populations.
Hickel believes he can establish fair and enforceable rules about subsistence through the regulatory powers of the executive branch. Hickel says native sovereignty is an outgrowth of the subsistence issue. He says he won't bow to those who want sovereignty, but suggested a new type of government, including second-class cities and IRA councils, might remove duplication and confusion. Hickel should get more specific about his plans in tomorrow night's budget address. He has already said the proposed 1991 budget will be leaner than this year's.
Now, these cuts may seem painful, but like any sensible diet, they will improve our health, not hurt it. I know of no government agency, federal or state, that could not absorb a 5% cut. We must become leaner in our operations.
Hickel gave his speech last night without interruption. During the course of it, he reiterated support for the statehood compact, vowing to fight the federal government in court if necessary. He does say Alaska will negotiate with Congress on major issues, but no deals will be made without the vote of the people. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. 3, 2, 1. The director of the governor's budget office, Shelby Stafney, says if communities are required to share the cost of capital projects, better decisions about how to spend the money will be made. The municipal matching grants proposed by the governor are based on a formula taking the community's population and wealth into consideration. Under that formula, Fairbanks would get a grant of $3.1 million next year, and the Fairbanks North Star Borough would get $4.7 million. The city and the borough would each have to come up with an equal amount to match those grants. City Mayor Wayne Nelson thinks the 50-50 proposition is a good one, and enables the public to get more involved over the community's needs. And if this idea of a capital grant becomes a reality, Nelson says the city's plans for a new police station in Old Main School fit right in.
With the idea of eventually making that one-stop government with the city hall and the police station and MUS offices there, so that the part of the government that most frequently comes in contact with the public would be in one place. Figure that we were looking at for doing that was $6.2 million. So keeping in mind that this still has to go to the legislature and that there's probably an awful lot of fiddling and politicking with the capital budget still to be done.
Nelson isn't alone in his line of thinking. City Councilman Jerry Norum also thinks the 50-50 funding proposal is better than nothing.
Before there was state funding, Fairbanks used to fund 100% of its needs in terms of capital improvements, and so to have a 50-50 opportunity is not a bad deal. I think we ought to, as a council, discuss it and come up with ways and means to approach it. The city of Fairbanks certainly needs a capital improvement program, including some local financing for that purpose. We used to be able to afford it. I think we can still afford it. We simply have gone into such a posture as we're not doing it. I think it's harmful to the city to stay in that posture, so I'd like to see us get out of it.
And Norum says this would be the opportunity for the council to take its idea of a new police station and city hall to the people. Issuing bonds to pay for those renovations would need the support of voters. He thinks the people will say yes to the plan. The borough's plans are less clear, since its priority capital projects are basically maintenance, not building projects. Borough Mayor Juanita Helms says it's not clear yet whether or not the grant could be used for deferred maintenance. But the borough may have to face head-on another idea launched by the Hickel administration. The issue, again, is local roads maintained by the state, known as Class 3 roads. There are several in the city and borough. This winter, snow removal on those roads was threatened when former Governor Steve Cooper vetoed money for that. That funding was later restored, but now Governor Hickel wants to begin transferring those roads to local communities. He hopes to transfer about 300 of the 1,800 miles of those roads this year to communities that already have the ability to maintain them. And the governor wants the legislature to give the municipalities $35 million to improve those roads. Budget Director Shelby Statsny says this is the first step in a five-step program, but the other steps may be farther down the road because not all communities now are prepared to maintain the roads. He says which roads to transfer haven't been determined yet, but they will be in areas that have public works departments. Shastny says it's time the local areas who deal with the roads take over the responsibility for them. But in the Fairbanks North Star borough, Mayor Juanita Helms says it would mean a new undertaking.
The only thing our borough could do is go to the ballot and ask the public if they want us to take over road powers, because we only have road powers in service areas. And those service areas exclude state-maintained roads. So our local people would have to determine by ballot whether they wanted to bear that cost of maintaining those roads.
The issue of borough road maintenance came up last summer after Cooper's veto, and some borough assembly members argued strongly that maintaining those roads is the state's responsibility unless the borough decides to do it for itself. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton. 3-2-1. Last summer, Judge Meg Green stopped the state from parceling out any more of the Mental Health Trust lands. The state dissolved the trust several years ago and used the land for other things, but the state Supreme Court said a few years ago that that was illegal. Reestablishing the trust hasn't been easy, though, since the state doesn't want to give the land back, but also doesn't want to pay what the beneficiaries say the land is worth. Last spring, the issue was close to being settled, but a deal in the State House fell apart during the last 2 days of the session. Attorney for the mental health beneficiaries, Jeff Jesse, thinks the results might be different this year.
The land freeze has been very disruptive to a lot of people in the state, and I think more and more legislators and the administration are realizing that this problem isn't going to go away. Like the savings and loan problem nationally, it's a problem that's going to be with us until they take care of it.
Jesse also says people who want to develop the lands currently tied up in the dispute have added another political pressure group to get a settlement. There are two things Jesse wants to see in any settlement. One is agreement the land is worth the more than $2 billion the commission says it's worth. The other is establishment of an independent trust authority. That group would administer the trust instead of the legislature. Jesse says the state has a conflict of interest as an administrator, since it can spend trust monies on other things after mental health needs are met and paid for. Fairbanks Representative Mark Boyer has introduced legislation in the House to resolve the mental health lands dispute. He says the bill is a way to get discussion started, and he's already considering amendments to it. Boyer says arguments over the land's value have doomed legislation in the past, but he doesn't see that as the main issue. The real issue, he says, is how much money is needed to pay for mental health needs, since that's what trust monies are to be spent on first.
The necessary expenses is what we fight about. We have no real definition of what the necessary expenses are. We have no statutory framework to determine what adequacy is. And that's really at the heart of the issue from my perspective, is that if we can get to some understanding of what is an adequate program, which then gives you the equation for the necessary expenses, we've solved the huge part of the problem.
Boyer says the independent trust authority may be the means to determine the necessary expenses, but he doesn't think the legislature will agree to let that group have financial control to administer the trust. Boyer thinks the legislature will keep its appropriation authority, which means enforcement will still be an issue.
And right now, the enforceability is the land. The fact that the core beneficiary groups were able to go to Meg Green and enjoin us from transferring or disposing or really having any kind of transactions on the balance of the mental health lands, I mean, that's an enforcement tool that works. It clearly works. And we have to probably, if we don't give them land or give them that enforcement tool, we have to decide on another enforcement tool.
Boyer says that issue will be hard to resolve in pounding out a settlement. His legislation calls for the courts to direct the legislature, but he doesn't think that's how the bill will ultimately end up. Boyer and Fairbanks Senator Steve Frank are part of an ad hoc committee that's been appointed to try to resolve the matter. Others on the committee include the beneficiaries' attorneys, the state attorney general, and the commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. They plan to meet next Tuesday and again the following week to try to come up with a settlement that makes everyone happy. For KUAC News, I'm Ann Thornton. In Fairbanks, I'm Ann Thornton.
If officials... Stolen property, vandalism, and sexual assault are just a few of the problems that have faced the University of Alaska Fairbanks in recent months. UAF officials hope that changes in campus security will help reduce crime. The university is in the process of upgrading its security department by hiring commissioned police officers and authorizing them to carry guns. The question of whether officers should carry weapons has been hotly debated. Dale Florian, director of security at UAF, thinks that it is a necessary step as well as a safe one.
These will be professionally trained and experienced people from other law enforcement agencies.
Florian says that people should not think of the guns as weapons, but as part of a police officer's uniform.
A piece of equipment for a police officer is a handgun as much as a hose is for a fireman.
Student opinions vary. Some, like this student, feel that the upgrade is necessary.
I think they should, because in case they do have problems like that, they can take care of them right away instead of having to wait for the state troopers to show up or anything else like city police or, you know, it's real good. They can just respond very quickly.
Other students aren't so sure.
The security that's here right now isn't doing a very good job, I don't think. And more of them, I don't think will solve the problem.
There'd certainly be a lot more potential for a mistake to be made. You know, people get shot on accident. I mean, it happens. But then again, I know if I was a cop, I'd sure want the ability to defend myself, you know, without just saying, stop or I'll shine my flashlight on you, you know.
Chancellor Patrick O'Rourke feels that UAF security needs some bite behind its bark.
If you wish to have a deterrent, and as you do in any municipality, you need to provide those individuals with the tools that they need to assure that that deterrent is effective. And I think for people to know that there is a university Department of Public Safety and that those individuals who staff that are commissioned to police officers and possess full arrest authorities and the rest of it, as well as armament, hopefully that'll be a good deterrent to any growth of violence or problems on the campus.
In a referendum earlier this week, students voted against having armed officers on campus. Chancellor O'Rourke says that vote will not have an impact on the decision to upgrade security.
This is not the type of issue that I think should be resolved by the vote of the students.
The public safety officers will spend late spring and early summer in training and will not begin carrying weapons on the job until late July at the earliest. For KUAC News, I'm Jeremy Vermillier.